Les colloques du Collège de France.
Bonjour encore une fois. I'm going to speak in English now because our next speaker is going to speak in English. Not that Celeste doesn't speak French, but she prefers speaking in English. It is a great, great pleasure for me to introduce Celeste Jingyan Pan, who is a student, a DPhil student, doctoral student at University of Oxford. Her work, she specializes in illuminated Hebrew manuscripts from medieval Ashkenaz, from medieval France and Germany, some parts of the German lands. And today she's going to share with us her observations about the identification of a scribe and different modes of script or different varieties of script of one particular scribe. Celeste, the screen is yours.
Thank you very much, Judith, and also for allowing me to give this presentation in the first place. I will be speaking about the problem of two related scripts in Hamburg Staatsuniversität's Bibliothek Codex Livy 19, which is a liturgical Pentateuch made in Brussels in 1309. So the liturgical Pentateuch was actually the most popular type of biblical manuscripts in Ashkenaz at around this time of 13th and 14th centuries. And it is essentially a biblical compendium, including biblical readings for liturgical services throughout the year. And it normally is divided into two or three parts, the first part always being the Pentateuch proper, so Genesis to Deuteronomy. And this is followed by a section of the Haftarot, which are prophetic readings that accompany the Torah readings in both weekly and festival services. And then finally, the slightly more optional part is the five scrolls, so books from the Hagiographa, Ruth, Song of Songs, Ecclesiastes, Lamentations, and Esther, and sometimes Job as well, which are additionally read for some of the festivals. And Job specifically was read by some communities for Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av, alongside Lamentations. And in Codex Livy 19, we find all three sections. In each of the section, the biblical text is normally accompanied by several other textual components, which coexist on the level of every page. And in this case, we have the Hebrew biblical text, the Masoretic text, alternating with the Targum, which is an Aramaic verse-by-verse translation of the Bible. And both texts are sort of given in the two central columns in square script. And then around the two central columns, we have Rashi's commentary, which was written in the late 11th century, and by this time, by the 13th and 14th centuries, had become quite a regular part of Ashkenazic liturgical Pentateuch manuscripts. And in this case, it is arranged in this bracket-like shape around the two central columns, and is normally, as it is here, written in a semi-cursive or non-square script rather than square. And in addition to these, we also have the Masorah, which is a set of textual critical apparatus or textual critical notes on the biblical text, which is separated into the Masorah Power, which are sort of these very heavily abbreviated notes that we find in between the columns, and the Masorah Magna, which is a more extensive sets of biblical sort of quotations containing the same word as that's occurring on the same page, and that's typically found on the upper and lower margins. And in this case, in the example I have shown on the left, the Masorah Magna is actually given in this camina figurata formation, so basically with the lines of the text being manipulated to form sort of the inside parts of an image, and then the Masoretes would draw around it in order to sort of give the actual sort of shape that he's trying to represent. In this case, he kind of is depicting a shield. I will just note there is some variation in the selection of textual content across the three sections. So the Pentateuch section being the most full, containing all of the components I have mentioned so far, whereas in the Haftarot section, the Targum, so the Aramaic translation, is omitted, as are both Masorah Power and Masorah Magna. And in the Five Scrolls and Job section, we do not have Masorah Magna for Job, and also but already midway through the Pentateuch, midway through the Book of Numbers, the Masorah Pagna had already broken off and it was not copied for the rest of the manuscript. And I'll discuss more of this later. So I guess in both of these respects, both the division of the manuscript into three parts containing the relevant textual components, and also in the design of the page with the textual components being kind of represented in this kind of hierarchical manner, Codex Livy 19 is relatively typical of its genre, but at the same time it is also highly unusual in one key respect, and that is its program of decoration. Now, I tend to think about the liturgical Pentateuch as the sort of Hebrew equivalent of Latin Psalters and Books of Hours, which were popular at around the same time, in the sense that both codicological types were supposed to be mainly made for private rather than communal use. They tend to be relatively portable, medium to small-sized, and a significant amount of these manuscripts also contain different degrees of decoration, and Codex Livy 19 actually counts among the dozen of more extensively decorated liturgical Pentateuch manuscripts that we have surviving from Ashkenaz, and it contains these four-page miniatures for the beginning of each of the three sections, sort of initial word panels for the beginning of all of the biblical books, where basically you have a decoration filling all the available gaps between and around the letters. And then the smaller textual divisions, the individual Haftarot and Parashiot, have these penwork panels, which were sort of obviously decorated by the same artist. And in addition to that, we have occasionally additional decoration at the end of books, in addition to what is already at the beginning, and also marginal decoration that basically illustrate the text that are found on the same page. So here we have an example for decorating a Haftarah from the Book of Jonah. So already this, having this extensive program of decoration divided into so many different types is unusual, but what is even more unusual is the fact that in this case we have conclusive evidence that the artist was not a Christian artist hired for the occasion, but a Jew. And we know this because the artist actually left his own colophon, which is a rhymed colophone, on the same page as the main scribal colophon, where he identified his role in the production of the manuscript. So in the second line he says, the drawing and the writing I completed together. And indeed the scripts that's used for this rhymed colophon, we also see accompanying decorated portions at various other points, and also the same hand corrected the biblical text after the vocalizers had already corrected them once. So he was actually able to go through the text after it had been both copied and vocalized. And he also noted down the total number of verses, words, and letters in each biblical book. So clearly this person not only participated in the decoration of the manuscript, he also went through the manuscript page by page, and he had clearly access to some sort of exemplar, and he was clearly functional as a scribe in addition to being an illuminator. So this makes Codex Livy 19 one of the few examples we have from Ashkenaz during this period where we can be sure that what we're dealing with is a Jewish rather than Christian artist, which makes it incredibly important for the study of Jewish book illumination during this period. And this also makes it important to consider who the artist was, how he learned his craft, how he worked, and how he interacted with his fellow craftsmen. That sort of leads me to basically list all the different people who partook in the production of the manuscript, beginning with the main scribe, Yitzhak ben Eliyahu Chazan me-Oxenfurt, which is ambiguous and could refer to either Oxford in England or Oxenfurt in Franconia. And I think sort of Oxford, which would have been pronounced and spelled Oxenford at the time, would have been the more likely, since for someone who had just left England in 1290 or in the years before that, Brussels would have been a relatively logical place to resettle, since it's just pretty much across the channel. Whereas for a Jew who was leaving Oxenford for, I don't know, a place of relative safety, then it seems very much that both moving south into northern Italy and moving east into Poland would have been more intuitive than moving north into Brussels, which only had a small and insignificant Jewish community at the time. So Isaac ben Eliyahu copied the two main columns where we find the Masoretic text and the Targum, and he also copies Rashi's commentary. As I said, a sort of non-square script, and it includes sort of two samples of his Aleph, just to give a very brief snapshot of how he wrote. And the other sort of scribe whose name we know is someone called Yehuda HaKohen, and he copies the Masorah Magna, but not the Masorah Power. And it was also him that basically gave all of these Camino Figurata designs, which I've shown on the second slide. And the Masorah Power was copied by an unnamed Masoretic, whom I call Masoretic C, who stopped copying at some point at folio 289, which is somewhere in Numbers. And we know that he was a contemporary of the other scribes rather than a later owner, because after this point, after folio 289, the ruling of the Rashi column actually was modified and brought slightly inwards to account for the fact that they no longer needed to leave space for the Masorah Power. And that very much suggests that the main scribe Yitzchak was not just aware that Masoretic C had stopped copying, but he also had no intention of employing another Masoretic to sort of complete the Masorah Power. And then in addition to that, we have two unnamed vocalizers, A and B, who changed hands very late in the manuscript at the beginning of a choir. And so we know that they were different from each other and different from the other scribes too, because they corrected the scribe's text at various points, sort of adding missing verses and phrases, and their sort of handwriting, basically the handwritings are different from all the others examined so far. And then finally, we have the artist and corrector of the manuscript, who did not leave his name as such, even though in the colophon he begins with the words Hineni Akud Hamor, I am the bound person of Mount Moria, which is a very elliptical way of saying that my name is Isaac or Isaac. And already, I guess, we face a somewhat unusual situation where both the main scribe and the main artist were called Isaac, and they also had rather similar handwritings. And even though the two sort of Alephs that I've shown are sort of written at different sizes and with clearly sort of different nibs, one sort of being much more calligraphic than the other, the overall shape of the letters is suspiciously similar. And this obviously leads to the question of whether they were the same person or not. And another sort of sign that they were actually strikingly similar to each other is in their overall role in the production process. And I don't believe that I have time to justify exactly why I decided upon this ordering. But I will just draw attention to the fact that the other artisans who worked on the manuscript, the two vocalizers, the Masoretic C and Yehuda HaKohen, only participated in one stage each of the production process, whereas both the main scribe Isaac ben Eliyahu and the main artist who called himself Akud Hamor were involved in multiple stages of the production process. So clearly they were sort of more sort of intimately involved, as it were, compared to the other parties. So it is interesting that for other sort of publications on this manuscript so far, the authors have tended to assume either possibility, either that the scribe also decorated the manuscript, or the scribe was a different person from the decorator, without really justifying why they arrived at such a conclusion. So basically the aim of this talk is to examine sort of the relationship between these two parties, basically from a paleographical angle, and try to approach the question of whether they were the same person or not. So it seems logical to begin with a comparison of the lettering themselves. And here I've included a sort of side-by-side an alphabet by the main scribe Ishaq and an alphabet by the artist corrector. And in terms of general observations, clearly, even though I've given them sort of at a one-to-one scale, the second line by the artist is actually much smaller and is written in a more less formal capacity with a nib that's narrow and therefore sort of makes less distinction between the sort of slightly thicker and slightly thinner strokes. And in general, the artist corrector script is also more squashed, basically more stretched out horizontally compared to the script by the main scribe. But when you look at specific letter forms, there are also some unusual similarities. In the letter Aleph, I had already mentioned with the kind of slight wave in the main oblique stroke, and also the sort of the slight tapering off effects since the left side of the letter is slightly taller than the right side. And the orientation of the foot and the arm is also practically the same. And then in the letter Gimel, we can note the kind of splaying out of the two downstrokes and the sort of strong waviness of the right-hand downstroke, which is not so common at the time. And also in both cases, the letter Gimel goes below the baseline slightly, so it's slightly longer than the other sort of letters, even though one cannot see it very clearly here. And in the letter Lamed, we have in both cases a very vertical mast and this sort of sharp angle formed between the roof and the downstroke. And in both letter Mem, sort of the letters relatively stretched out horizontally, and then sort of the arm on the left is proportionally quite large compared to the rest of the letter. In the case of the letter Pe, we have this kind of very wide central cavity accompanied by this very small nose, and also this sort of spur on top of the roof is found in both scripts. In the case of both Ai and Tzadi, sort of the angling of this kind of sort of diagonal sort of stroke, the arm here and also the downstroke here, sort of being close or horizontal is quite unusual. And in the case of the letter Shin, we have this, again, nearly a vertical left arm and also this overall strongly triangular shape of the letter. But then on the other hand, there are also obvious differences. The first being this zigzag shape that we find on the sort of the right side of some of the letters. So Bet here, also Mem Sofit, Pe, and Tade as well, which we see less in the main scribe script. But I believe that in this case, the difference and the relative absence of the zigzag shape can actually be explained by the different type of nib used. And as I tried to demonstrate here, even if the same kind of zigzag shape is being described by the hand of the scribe, the thickness of the letter actually obscures the zigzagging slightly. And what we end up having is something that looks relatively straight, even though the movement is there. And whereas with something that is written with a narrow nib, that zigzag shape is preserved, which is why it is more pronounced. And obviously, it is still more exaggerated in the case of the corrector script, but I think in this case, the difference is justifiable. But then something that is slightly less justifiable is the orientation of some of the downstrokes. So we have that in Dalet, in He, in Het, in Tav, and also in Resh, where in the corrector's script, the downstroke goes inwards, so the letter kind of closes down as we go from top to bottom. Whereas in the case of the main scribe scripts, the throat goes outwards and then the letter opens up. And that's something that could potentially be explained by the corrector scripts being less formal, but then it is not so conclusive, and one can also easily use that as evidence that these two were indeed different people. So it seems that overall, sort of the comparison of the letter forms themselves is inconclusive. And so I thought of using other types of paleographical evidence that do not concern the letters themselves. So I decided first to look at the use of justification marks and specifically the use of space fillers. So in Hebrew manuscripts generally, and especially in Ashkenaz during this period, scribes were very much concerned with keeping a relatively neat left-hand margin as well as a neat right-hand margin. And they do this with a combination of techniques. So sometimes they elongated individual letters so that they reach the end of the line. They sometimes compress letters, and I think we also have some examples of it here. Sometimes they write out the first letter of the first word of the next line and then sort of cancel it out by putting dots on them. But also at other times they use space fillers, which are these sort of nonsensical symbols that look like letters but are recognizably not a letter. And then they would basically occupy the remaining space between the final word and the edge of the text block. And then the text continues as it sort of normally does in the next line. And then the choice of these space fillers by the scribes are very much individual to the scribes themselves, since there's no standardization and each scribe basically decided on their own symbol and tended to sort of stick with it. So on the left, I have some examples of space fillers by the character Akud Hamar, where he basically uses this shape, which is similar to the number 7, even though it varies a bit in the size of the symbols in the relative proportions, and also in whether the turning here between the horizontal and diagonal bits, sort of whether it is more angular and or whether it's more rounded. And then on the right, I provide two examples of the main scribe Ishaq's space filler in the main text, where he uses a very similar graphic filler shaped like a number 7. And once again, there is some variation to the shape and size of the fillers, and also the nature of this turning, some being round and some being more angular. Whereas in his Rashi column, where the script itself is more rounded than angular, we only find the 7 shapes with the rounded turnings, which is a bit more like an elongated comma. So already this comparison shows a striking amount of similarity between the space fillers used by the artist corrector and the fillers used by the scribe. But it still does not prove necessarily that they were the same person, because this space filler could have been a relatively common one at the time, and many scribes could be using it in a similar way. So as a counter evidence, I list along the bottom this the graphic filler used by the Masoret Yehuda HaKohen in a group of consecutive folios. And it is clearly shown that he resorted consistently to a very different graphic filler, which is shaped like a number 5. And the only variation being that in some cases the horizontal bar is lengthened in cases where the gap is particularly large. But even this is not statistically convincing enough. So I just chose to sample several more liturgical Pentateuch manuscripts which have some form of decoration and which were made within 2 or 3 decades of Levi 19, also in Ashkenaz. And here basically I give a sample of a random folio, in which case I just chose folio 14 verso in all of them, and also a selection of the graphic fillers in detail. And as one can see, sort of each scribe basically renders the graphic filler slightly differently, even though in general they follow the same kind of concept of somehow an upper horizontal stroke being followed by something else as vertical and which turns at the bottom. And they very much look like a signature of some sorts, and each scribe having the distinct ways of doing it. And it also shows that actually the 7 shape that is favored by the main artist corrector and the main scribe is by no means common, and actually the majority of these look slightly more similar to the number 5 preferred by the Masoret than to the number 7. So this already increases the likelihood that the main artist character and the main scribe were probably the same person. But I wondered whether there were other forms of evidence that one could draw on. So I look at something else which is even further from the realm of scripts per se, and that is basically the use of penwork flourishes by the two scribes. So on the left, I give an example of this a random squiggle produced by the artist corrector Agud Hamo, which consists of these kind of small circles that give way to this wavy line towards the bottom, and he uses it for basically completing this reverse pyramid shape at the end of a text block, or in this case just at the end of a very short liturgical note. Sort of further sort of below, we have two examples in the Rashi column sort of featuring flourishes by the main scribe, which are very similar to the above, consisting of two circles and wavy lines, and also fulfilling the same function of completing a triangular shape. Whereas on the right, we have an even more ubiquitous penwork flourish, which basically is based on this kind of forked descender motif, where basically one forked descender from the letter Kuf and sometimes from the letter Gimel as well gives rise to another one facing the opposite direction, and this branches off into another one, etc. And then sort of each end of the fork would then sort of lead to this groups of three wavy lines. And then we see that both in the square scripts column copied by the main scribe and also in the Rashi column accompanying the semi-cursive script. And in the case of the artist corrector, we see him using the same motif in a slightly sort of more sort of current, slightly sort of more casual way, also in combination with the letter Kuf. And I guess the only substantial difference is that in this case, the kind of space between the forks is not really filled in as it is here. And that could, again, be explained perhaps by the fact that because he was using a thinner nib, it would have been sort of more difficult to cover sort of relatively large areas of space with one or two single strokes. And once again, sort of these could very well be common penwork flourishes being copied by Hebrew scribes at the time. So I choose to look at a few more manuscripts. And in fact, there are many scribes who do not use any type of penwork flourishes whatsoever, and some who only uses very basic ones, such as these kind of cross-hatch patterns sort of forming a hat-shaped, whereas already sort of the use of any significant penwork flourishes is already quite rare. So I managed to just give four example. And as you see, there's relatively sort of remarkable consistency within each manuscript as to what type of penwork flourish each individual scribe preferred. They're also relatively different from what was practiced by Akut Hamor and the main scribe, and indeed sort of designs that are based on the palmet or based on the acanthus or the fleur-de-lis are actually much more common than something more abstract, like both of these examples. Before I finish, I'll just look at one further type of penwork flourish that is especially peculiar and especially a trademark of this manuscript in particular, which is the use of the swirl motif. So I have listed all of these examples in chronological order, and not really in the order of foliation, but in the order in which they would have been added to the manuscript, and I include on the right a reminder of the order of work. So I begin with the main text copied by the main scribe Yitzhak ben Eliyahu. And here is a very early example of him experimenting with the swirl design. And it is obvious that he was not exactly comfortable with this design yet. The lines have this relatively shaky quality, which is no doubt connected also to the fact that he was using a wide nib. So in order to actually conserve the same width of the stroke as he kind of negotiates these turnings, is actually not very easy. Correspondingly, the sort of the shape and the size of the swirls is not very consistent, and the overall design has a slightly sort of hesitant quality. Whereas later, when the corrector Akut Hamor was adding a missing word to the biblical text, he also habitually adds some swirls, and in this case the lines have become slightly steadier even though there's the same unevenness in the swirls themselves. And then even later in the Rashi column, this is where we find a significant number of these swirl type penwork flourishes, and we actually see the main scribe getting more comfortable with the design in the course of time. So he begins still being slightly shaky in the lines, but increasingly the swirls become very regular, very even, and then the designs themselves also become more sophisticated and extensive over time. And then even later, when it came to decorating the smaller initial word panels with penwork, we see the artist Akut Hamo basically creating these very complex, very dense networks of swirls. And then he had kept initially these groups of three bracket-like lines, which we see very much everywhere in the Rashi column. But soon, even these bracket-like lines were abandoned. And then towards the end of the manuscript, we have the more sort of geometrically pure network of just the swirls themselves being interconnected. And in the final stage, where he added the sort of fully illuminated panels, the swirls are kind of used in an even more systematic and regular manner. And sort of this technical progression seems much easier to explain if it was done by a single scribe who basically experimented with the form and grew incredibly comfortable with it, and sort of tried to sort of push it into sort of more complex arrangements, rather than trying to imagine it in a scenario with two different people passing the motif back and forth and one trying to copy the other in a sort of obsessive and sort of rather inexplicable manner. So it very much seems to me that the two parties, the main scribe and the main artist, were actually the same person. And if we sort of accept this hypothesis, then it means that we will have to sort of revise the order of work which I had given earlier. And assuming that basically it was the same person, Yitzhak ben Eliyahu, who added both the text and the decoration, then he actually would have been responsible for the majority of steps in the production process. And we can very much view this manuscript as his project, where a few other scribes also contributed. And this also allows us to basically look at the colophon page in a new light, not necessarily as one sort of colophon page containing two separate colophons by two artists, but sort of two colophons by the same person separated in time, one basically marking the completion of the copying of the text and the other marking the completion of the manuscript as a whole. And it also explains why the artist would be so reluctant to mention his name. And it seems that it would not have been done because he was uneasy with the idea of disclosing his name, but because he had already done it on the same folio. So there's in a sense no need to do it again. And this also means that when he says that he completed the drawing and the copying together, it is by no means an exaggeration, and he did not sort of interpret the correction itself to be a form of copying, but he actually was being completely truthful in saying that he was responsible basically for both the text and the image. And then finally, it also sort of makes me think more about the placement of this random human head that had been attached to the foliate border sort of along the upper margin. So in other sort of illuminated initial word panels, these foliate borders normally give way to a dragon's head, and only very rarely to a human head. And it seems to me that the presence of the human head here might have been connected to the fact that the words Ani Yitzhak, I am Yitzhak, appears just beneath it. So it seems probable, at least, that this human head was actually intended to be some type of self-portrait. And perhaps here we have a very sort of early and rare example where a Jewish scribe artist was able to basically sign his word off, both by means of text and also by means of an image. Thank you very much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.